Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in, I guess, one of the most exciting chapters in the prophet Isaiah. This is such a superb piece of literature. It has a climax. It has a surprise. And then it has an application and interpretation. It's a beautiful passage. I think what had happened by this time, we don't know when historically this psalm fits in the life and ministry of Isaiah, what a particular king or historical situation, but many have surmised that maybe it's a time where the people had begun to kind of tune off the prophet. And the prophet designed a new method to get their attention, a new method to convey his God-given revelation. And so apparently at some festival, maybe in the marketplace, maybe in the temple, we're not sure. But this was common of that day for minstrels or the singers of songs to perform publicly. And Isaiah takes on that role. And he moves into a marketplace and begins to sing a song about a friend, a relative, a close companion. Now let's look at the outline of this, if we could, for a minute, because I think it's striking in its structure. This was not extemporaneous. It was probably very thought through. Verses 1 through 6 are this parable song. Verse 7 is the climactic surprise twist that gives the focus of the entire parable song. And then in verses 8 through 23... is a series, I think, of seven woes of judgment that's going to fall. This chapter is all judgment. It's unrelated to the chapters ahead of it, but not a literary connection. There is no hope in this chapter. It's all judgment on the people of God. There's a great similarity between the judgment that falls on the people of God because they had so much knowledge of God, to whom much is given, much is required. The same type of literature is found in the letter to the seven churches in Revelation chapters 2 and 3. And then in verses 24 through 30 is judgment that comes. The woes are on particular kinds of sins. That would be 8 through 23. And then the judgment of God seems to be two kinds. The judgment in nature, going back to Deuteronomy 27 and 28, that God is in control not only of history, but a control of nature. And then about the invader. Now, there's been a lot of hair pull about whether this is Assyria or Babylon. In the immediate context of chapter 7 and chapter 10, Assyria is the invader to take the northern 10 tribes. But Isaiah wrote to Judah. Judah is referred to. Cyrus is also mentioned in the larger context of Isaiah, which would be the Persian Empire, which would deliver them from the Babylonian captivity. So it could refer to Babylon, or it could refer to Assyria. And I'm not exactly sure which it really is. It's kind of ambiguous and therefore may refer to both. Let's look at it if we could. Let me sing now my well-beloved, the song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. Two different words for beloved, but very similar here. Matter of fact, I believe it's the Vulgate that translates this first one, uncle. And that's the usual meaning, uncle. But here it seems to be relative, friend, companion. Now, it's interesting, he's going to sing a song about his companion, but down in verse, and just a few more verses, the companion is going to speak, first person. So he's going to speak about God, but God's going to break in and speak for himself. Notice it says, my well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. Now, vineyard, as well as the olive tree, as well as the, the grapevine, were all symbols of the nation of Israel. Now, on this fertile hill literally means the horn of the hill, son of fatness, or son of oil. Now, what basically it meant was the ideal place for a vineyard was on the side of a hill that was well drained, that faced the sun almost the whole day. No trees, open ground. That became a very sought-after kind of field for a grapevine, and that's what this is referring to. Now, notice it says, and he dug it all around and removed its stones and planted in it the choicest vines and built a tower in the middle of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. Now, this gives us some of the characteristics of agriculture of that day. Now, we're not exactly sure of what these Hebrew words mean. King James says he fenced it here instead of he dug in it. Now, this is not so much hoeing, although one of my favorite commentators in the Old Testament, Leupold, says it means to be hoed. But I think it meant that the a vineyard we know of were plowed, not hoed. So I think the hoed here means they dug a ditch all the way around the field. And they would take the dirt and throw it up on the inside wall. And then on top of that wall, they would plant thorn bushes and cactus kind of plants. Now, the ditch and the cactus were a protection. Now, inside this ditch and cactus or thorn bushes, there was a rock fence usually built from the rocks removed from the field. Not the little ones, but the big ones. And it made a fence. And this was the way of protecting the vineyard. And so we had this double line, the ditch, the thorns, and the rock fence. Now, in a minute, it's going to say he's going to tear down the walls. Not only were there this large wall of rocks around the field, but you've seen it some in the terracing methods of farming in our day. They would use some of the rocks to make contour lines through the field and level the dirt out so that it would retain moisture. So when it rained, it all wouldn't run off. So it had these little walls in the field and this large wall around the field. Now, in the midst of the vineyard somewhere, they would build a tower. Not every vineyard had a tower. Some just had a booth on a high part of the field. But many had a tower, and these were occupied by servants during the summer months when the fruit was ripening. And then about September, usually the farmer and his whole family would move into the field and stay there until the harvest was complete. Now, we know of some larger landowners who allowed these towers to be the homes of the men who stayed there in the summer, but usually they were just occupied parts of the year. Now, this word, choicest vines, this means sorek, S-O-R-E-K, grapes. We learn of them from Judges 16:4, a valley close to Hebron that had these grapes. The spies found that went in from Joshua. Large red grapes. And they're mentioned again in Jeremiah 2:21, the very best grapes possible. What this is saying is setting the stage that this farmer, this landowner, had done everything possible in his day to have the best vineyard around. I mean, he made provision for everything. The soil was ready. The grounds, as far as the accoutrements needed for a vineyard, were in place. He bought the best vines. But notice what's going to happen. In fact, he even already made a wine vat, which basically you had a kind of a wooden container or an earthen container where the grapes were stepped on, and then they flowed out of a small hole into like a cistern, a hollowed-out rock formation where the wine was kept. And he expected it to produce good grapes. Now, usually it took the third year to produce grapes, so we have the idea of total provision and patience here, but it produced only... Now, my New American Standard has worthless grapes, but basically, it's a stronger term than that, stinking grapes, foul grapes, worthless grapes. Now, I think this is a good place to say, this is something like Matthew chapter 7, by their fruits you shall know them. The people of God, with all of the light and all the revelation and all of the special care of God and all of His provisions, turned away from Him. Oh, friend, when your light becomes darkness, how great is the darkness? To whom much is given, much is required. Judgment begins in the household of God. It begins here. In verse 3, the prophet uses a literary technique. He speaks to his audience and says, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah," notice he's not addressing Israel, that he's addressing Judah. He spoke to the southern tribes. Isaiah is one of the 8th century prophets. We have Amos and Hosea speaking to the northern 10 tribes, for the kingdom split in 922 under Rehoboam, Solomon's son. But the southern 2 tribes were spoken to, really southern 3 tribes, by Isaiah and Micah. So I think this, when it refers to captivity, I think it's referring to the Babylonian captivity in the context of Isaiah's message, though it could refer to Assyria that took the northern 10 tribes captive in 722 B.C. Notice it mentions then, judge between me and my vineyard. Notice that it is not about someone. The person himself, the owner of the vineyard, is speaking here, i.e. God is speaking. What more was there for me to do for my vineyard that I have not done for it? The blame was not God's. The blame of a wayward Israel is not on God's shoulder. The blame of a wayward, apathetic, materialistic, unconcerned church is not God's problem. It's our problem. God's done everything for us. We have sought out for our own way. Why then, when I expected to produce good grapes, did it produce stinking ones? So now let me tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. Notice the eyes in verses 5 and 6. Several of them. And he's going to remove all of the advantages that he put there. The hedge of thorns, the wall for protection and security, for irrigation. He's going to tear down all the things he had given them. And the land is going to become invaded not only by strangers, but by animals, both domestic and wild. It's going to completely be destroyed. Here is God judging his own people for their lack of faith and love and covenant fidelity. So God is going to judge his own. Well, that's scary to us, but it's so true. I will lay waste to it. Now, another possible translation is, I will let it go to waste. Now, you seem to have an active judgment of God in verse 5 and a passive judgment of God in verse 6. Many have related this to Romans 1, 24 and 28, and I think you might want to see that. Notice there's no rain going to fall on it. God's in control of nature. Now, this all goes back to the promises of the covenant back in Deuteronomy 27 and 28. God said, if you will, I will. I'll be with you. I'll bless you. But if you don't, all the curses of that covenant come into being. Now, notice you go to verse 7. And here's the climactic switch here. Here's the punchline. Here's the terrible irony. Here's the hammer of God. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. You say, oh my, he must be talking about the northern 10 tribes. No, the nation of Judah is mentioned in the next line here. This is either referring to all of God's people, which is possible. Israel means the sons of Jacob, of course. But what he's saying is, you're the vineyard. I've had special care for you, and yet you have not. Notice if you go where it says, and the men of Judah, his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. Now what we have here is words that sound very much alike in Hebrew. You really can't get it in English, and I don't think there's any reason for us to try. In your notes, I've given you the Hebrew words, and you can see how close they are. It's a play on words. Now, here the ethical, moral nature, the holiness of God is revealed. His holiness was meant to be revealed in his children, his people. But instead of having the family characteristics of justice and righteousness and compassion and love and kindness and gentleness, his people were vicious with one another, greedy, drunkards. And we'll see that in the woes that follow. Now, this parable has been somewhat picked up by Jesus and told in similar ways in the New Testament, shocking ways. You might want to see this in Matthew 21, verses 33 through 46, a devastating story of the people of Israel. Mark 12, 1 through 12, Luke 20, 9 through 19. Now, beginning in verse 8 and down through 23 is a series, I think, of seven woes. Though you have to provide the word woe in verse 23 to make it seven. And, of course, my favorite commentator in the Old Testament, Leupold, does that. But it may be simply there is six of them here because six is the human imperfection. That's what we're talking about. So it may just be six. And they're kind of overlapping. Let's look at the first one. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there's no more room. Verses 8 through 10 are basically those who are greedy, wealthy landowners, those who are ripping off the poor. Now, if you know the background historically of Isaiah, it was a day of cultural prosperity, a day of military victory, a day of outward religiosity. But the wealthy class was exploiting the poor, taking great advantage of them, and that's what we have here. Notice this idea about, for 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. Now, 10 acres, literally in Hebrew, is the word yoke. And it refers to a yoke of oxen, and the way you told the amount of land was how much one oxen could plow in one day. So about 10 acres would be what an oxen could plow in 10 days. Notice where it says a bath. That's a dry measure. It's some disagreement, about 8 to 10 gallons. And then notice it says a homer of seed will yield but an ephah. Well, the amazing thing about that, and we learned this from Ezekiel 45:11, there were 10 ephahs in a homer. So what it says is, let's say you have 100 pounds of seed here. When you reap your harvest, you only have 10 pounds of seed coming out of 100 pounds of seed. Can you tell what God's done? He's devastated agriculturally. These rich farmers are going to lose their land because they're... Notice verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them. Now, here's the condemnation of drunkards. Now, I want to say again, the Bible rails against drunkenness, rails against the inappropriate use of alcohol or intoxicants. But it's not intoxicants that are the problem. It's man's abuse of intoxicants that's the problem. The Bible, particularly in Psalms 104, teaches that wine is a gift from God. The book of Ecclesiastes says, give wine to the suffering, the hurt, and the heart of labor. So it's not wine, it's us. Now, this is what it mentions here. Strong drink is basically the idea of adding stronger intoxicants to wine, other grain liquors, if you please. Now, the Bible has many instances about drunkenness. Another beautiful parallel in Isaiah is Isaiah chapter 28. Some striking condemnation of the abuse of alcohol is found in Proverbs 20, verse 1, and Proverbs 23, 29 through 35. It's a serpent. It will bite you. Be careful of it. Now, notice if you mentioned then, so I would say that verses 11 and 12 are, and because it mentions tambourines and music, that'd be the cultural way of their day, the amusements and recreation. I would say it's the sin of pleasure and leisure to the extreme. We have greed. We have pleasure and leisure here. Notice, if you would, when it says they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of His hands. Oh, friends, that's the problem with us thinking we have our own resources. We do our own thing. Life is just what we make of it. I tell you, it is not. It is from the hand of God that we receive anything and everything we have. And here His own people who forgot Him. Notice verse 24, D and E. Boy, and a beautiful one is Deuteronomy 8, 11 through 20, where Moses says, don't get in these houses you didn't build, in these fields you didn't make. And then when everything's going well, say, look what I've done for myself. No, my friend, you've done nothing for yourself. You deserve nothing. It's all from the hand of God. We need to hear that and remember that. Then in verse 13 it says, therefore my people go into exile. Now here's the mention. Is it Babylon or Assyria? I'm just not sure. Assyria is mentioned in chapter 7, verse 18, chapter 10, verses 5 and following. But Judah is also mentioned, and she goes into captivity under Babylon. Cyrus, the one who'll deliver them from the Babylonian captivity, the Persian king, is mentioned specifically in Isaiah 44 and 45. They go into exile for their lack of knowledge. Now, it's not a lack of knowledge due to ignorance. It's a lack of knowledge due to willful rejection. You might want to see Isaiah 1:3, and I guess the classic passage is Hosea chapter 4, verse 6. Notice in verse 14 that Sheol is personified as an animal opening wide its mouth to eat more and more. You might want to see Proverbs 1:12. Let's see. And notice, if you would, Jerusalem and Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her den of rivalry, and her jubilant within her descend into it. Now, here's the, if I could paraphrase this, friends, the good old boys are going to hell. That's what it's all about. We don't go around just once in life and get all the gusto you can of it. Now, this is not just our own resources and what we know with our five senses. There is a righteous God who's going to bring every man into account for his words and his deeds. There is an afterlife where things will be set straight. There is a judgment coming. Now, notice in verse 15 it mentions the common man and the man of importance. This is simply a cultural way, playing on the word Adam and Isha, two different words for man, of saying that from the highest to the lowest will come into judgment. Notice it says the eyes of the proud will be abased. Now, I think this is the same idea in verse 15, found down in verses 20 and 21, where light is turned to darkness and pride turns into arrogance. Oh, my. Notice it says, and the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment. Now, friends, Israel is going to reveal God. She meant to reveal God in prosperity and walking with Him in abundance. But whether she fails to do that, she will reveal God in moral judgment. That's the same with the church. We are witnessing. It's just what kind of witnessing we're doing. God said, I will be exalted, even if it's in judgment. And the holy God will show Himself holy in righteousness. Now, verse 17 has caused a lot of translation problems, a lot of interpretation problems. It's either one of three things. God's care for the poor who have been ostracized, a possibility. But the context goes against that. Number two, result of the judgment of the wealthy. That's a possibility. Number three, the remnant that's left in the land after the exile. I think in context it's saying that these lambs and Septuagint has kids instead of strangers. But what it's saying is the poor of the land are going to have the land of the wealthy. Or the wealthy are going to be so put down that the strangers and animals are going to eat on their pastures. Something like that, but I'm not exactly sure. Notice the next woe begins in verse 18, and this is really a practical atheism. It's those guys who say, well, yes, we believe in God. Now let him show himself. Let his judgment come quickly that we may know. Oh, folks, it's this idea of saying, oh, Jesus loves me and singing in church and praying in church, but living your life in a total secularism. Claiming to believe in God, but living as if there were no God. It's this practical atheism I think is spoken of here in verses 18 and 19. God is in control of history. That we may know it seems to be a sarcasm in verse 19. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Now, some have said these verses refer to the judges of Israel, who, like the king, were meant to typify God. And here they were perverting justice for a bribe, down in verse 23. I'm not sure if that's who it's referring to, but it is the idea of light becoming darkness. What's obviously of God being turned around. Notice in verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes. Oh, friends, look at Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24. Wisdom is a gift from God. And great wisdom is not in how much you know and how much you can manipulate people and how much money you can make. Real wisdom is in knowing God. And folks, knowing God means living like you know God. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine. This word heroes meant mighty warriors. The sarcasm. Instead of being a mighty warrior for God, they're mighty warriors and who can drink the most. Sound like us, doesn't it? Who justify the wicked for a bribe. Oh my. Now, who take away the rights of ones who are in the right. Here's the perversion. God's always on the side of those who are experiencing injustice. For whatever reason, socially, legally. I want to tell you, God is on the side of the poor, the widow, the alien, the orphan, the ostracized. And verse 24 and following is judgment. Verse 24 is kind of a summary of what's going to happen. Verse 25 begins the specific or specificity kind of actions that God will control nature. And then in verses 26 through 30 speaks of the invader. Therefore, as the tongue of fire consumes stubble, and fire is often used as a metaphor for judgment, the grass collapses into the flame. The grass is often used of the transitoriness of man versus the eternality of God. And I want to see, I believe Isaiah 55 is where that is. So their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust. Now this means a metaphor for ultimate destruction. As the fruit of the plant withers and dies, the root of the plant withers and dies. Friends, if the seed dies and the root dies, the plant's gone. This is the people of God being referred to. And why all this judgment? For they have rejected the word of the Lord. They have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Not of ignorance, but of willful rejection. We do not need more word from God. We need to act on the word of God we already know. If we act on the word of God we already know, God will always provide more light, more knowledge. Our problem is not lack of knowledge quite often. It's rejection of knowledge. But this is why we face many of the problems we face. It's not only the demonic out there. We're the problem. We turn away. Self pulls us away from God. Oh, my. On this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people. Notice it's the wrath of God against his people. Friends, the wrath of God is as biblical as the love of God. It's directed toward those who know him even hotter than those who do not. The lowest part of hell is for those who have known and rejected. Now, notice it mentions about an earthquake here in verse 25. Some say this is the earthquake mentioned in Amos chapter 1, verse 1, and alluded to in Zechariah 14, 5. Maybe there was a temporal judgment that came into history in the form of this earthquake, and it must have been a bad one because the corpses lay in the street rotting. Now, for a Jew to be unburied was horrendous. It was the ultimate act of judgment. And so we see nature judgment here. Now, down in verse 26, and he, God, will lift up a standard to the nations far off. Notice God's in control of nature, God's in control of history. Now, the word standard is some kind of signal, a signal fire, a signal flag, a signal light, something like that. It seems to be an allusion here to Deuteronomy 8, 49 and following. Now, the word goyim, plural, nations, is usually altered by most translations, RSV, NEB, to nation, goy, because you're going to use it in the singular, the next word, next little phrase when it says it from. Well, I think it should be plural. It probably refers to this invading army, which is made up of mercenaries from all the other conquered countries. So it made an army of many countries, though led by one country. Now, it could be Assyria that took the north. It could be Babylon that took the south. I'm not sure. But notice, God controls this invasion. Now, the promise given to Israel in Isaiah 40, 29 through 31, that she'll walk and not grow weary, she'll run and not go tired, she'll move up like a mat up with eagle's wings, that promise to Israel is in the next few verses given to the invading army. They won't grow tired. They won't be stoppable. They're going to move and not grow weary. It's an invincible invader, and they're empowered by God against his own people. Now, we ought to hear that. If America gets to the place that she thinks she's a Christian nation because we have in God we trust on our coins, and yet our lifestyle is totally godless, I want you to know God will raise up a godless country to judge us. It's happened before. It'll happen again. Now, the rest of this you can just read. It's the whirl of judgment around the people of God. I do believe that once we are truly redeemed, that it's the grace of God that keeps us. I believe that Jesus' blood cleanses from all sin. But I want to tell you, my Christian friend, you're going to give an account before God of what you've done in the body. You're going to give an account of every idle word and every idle deed. Judgment Day is not going to be all hallelujahs for us. It's going to be a day of bitter weeping as we see those we have not witnessed to, as we see those things that we did not do. Yes, God forgives, but man is responsible. Hope you'll read Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 through 10. I've enjoyed being with you. May the Lord bless you. In Jesus' name.